So, in case any of you saw any pigs flying past this morning, yes, the draft of the syllabus was posted, as well as all of the notes up to date, except for whatever reason I didn't have last Friday's written notes with me when I brought my scanner in this morning. So they must be on my desk at home, so I'll upload those with today's notes. But we're otherwise caught up, although the syllabus is not complete, because the individual topics that I break out on the second page of the schedule, I hadn't done that yet, and I still need to go back and fill in the sample problems and such. But at least you've got the topic order and all the dates and of the quizzes, exams, lab quizzes and such. Those are all in the syllabus. I'll remind us that we already got the page numbers for Lab 2 and that the pre-lab for Lab 2 is due on this upcoming Tuesday. We have not yet discussed what will be done for lab report for Lab 1, so don't worry about that at this point. Focus on your quiz, but we'll discuss that on Tuesday after we do a discussion of our next lab. Yes? The all those numbers were wrong. Oh, did I update them? Maybe on your version of the syllabus, I didn't update the numbers. But when I finish the syllabus update, I'll be putting the rest of those in. And the experiment names are all correct. So it is absolutely positively sure that we're doing the Robinson annulation, which I believe was on pages 625 through 628 with the procedure 628 to 629. Yes? We're doing Lab 2 next Tuesday. Yes, we are. Now we have the quiz Tuesday as well, so I thought I would do a little bit of review. And let me tell you, though, one of the few times I'll say not to worry about something. Do not worry about alpha hydrogens for the quiz, because they're related to aldol condensations and all those other condensations that we're going to start next week. So if I was going to ask you about alpha protons, it makes more sense to do it on the test after you've gotten those condensations. What types of things do you need to worry about for the quiz? Well, I think I already hinted that at least somewhere on the quiz or the exam, we're going to cover the relative reactivity of carboxylic acid derivatives. Now I know I still haven't come back and made a formal pronouncement as to whether it really is esters or whether it really is carboxylic acids that's a more reactive. Don't worry about that difference then. What matters is both of them are much more reactive than amides, and both of them are much less reactive than acyl halides or anhydrides. So as long as you know that overall order, you'll be fine. Here's another main topic, the cationic versus anionic mechanisms as applies to carboxylic acids. And we've seen examples of each, Fischer esterification and acid hydrolysis. Those are reverse reactions of each other, and they're cationic. And then we have things like saponification or reduction or alkylation that are anionic reactions. But aside just from those two classes, I want to revisit the idea of reversibility. For example, why is it that cationic reactions are usually fully reversible? Does anybody have a reasonable explanation for that? protonation, to say it a little bit more fully, whether we protonate one oxygen versus another, there's usually not very much energetic difference between the different oxygens we might protonate. So there's not much energy difference between the various intermediates. Makes it easy to go between the different intermediates. Also, there is this lingering question about which is more reactive or more, to use the bad word, stable, a carboxylic acid or an ester. The point is they're so close in energy that, again, it's not difficult to go back and forth between one or the other. So the intermediates are so similar in energy, the products and reactants are so similar in energy, that that's why the reaction is so reversible. So in this statement I'm going to make, think of an example such as esterification. Often the products and reactants are very similar in energy. And more importantly, the intermediates are similar in energy. The comment I made a minute ago was one protonated oxygen does not greatly differ from another protonated oxygen in terms of energy. Now that's for cationic mechanisms. What about anionic mechanisms? Why is it that they are sometimes reversible? Of course, the word sometimes also means that they are not reversible in other situations. Well, let's look at saponification as an example, because part of the saponification reaction is reversible. Of course, part isn't, and that's going to be a follow-up to this topic. Let's start with some simple ester, my classic fallback case of ethyl acetate. It reacts with hydroxide. Hydroxide pushes that carbonyl open. And I won't write the arrow in between yet, because let's discuss first. But let's see what would result. We do end up with an alkoxide. Now, hydroxide is the conjugate of water. And that conjugate pKa is 15.7. We make an alkoxide as a product. If we ignore the fact that there are other oxygens attached to the same carbon as that alkoxide, which means they would potentially have some form of inductive effect, but let's ignore it for now, we could guesstimate that a secondary alkoxide, or this is quasi-primary, I guess we would have to say, it's probably got a pKa around 16 or 17, let's say. Even if I'm wrong, because there are inductive effects, it's not going to be much different than this. So the point here is that the base strength of the hydroxide we start with is not appreciably different than the base strength of the alkoxide we end up with. And therefore, since there's not that much difference, this portion of the mechanism is reversible. Now, I was asked in the previous section, why are we dealing with pKa values? Or why are we, say, worried about the conjugate? Realize that pKa means how likely a proton is to come off. But in these two cases, it's already come off. And the number you use to describe pKa is not associated with a base. It's associated with the acid itself. If I wanted to directly compare base strengths, I would need to use pKbs. But given that every time I say the word pKb, most people cringe and think, no, don't go there. Forget Chem 1b. Stick with pKa. You know, that's kind of the natural reaction, which is why I always do discuss things in terms of pKa. So remember that if there was a big difference in pKa, that means there's a big difference in their conjugate bases. In this case, there's not that difference, so the bases are similar, which is why it's reversible. Now let's look at a situation where it's not reversible. Because what if we did, for example, a Grignard reaction instead? The mechanism looks very similar. We start out with an ester. Oh, before I finish this off, since we did determine that that previous step was reversible, I'll write a reversible arrow in. Now, down below here, I was working on a Grignard reaction. Let's just keep our reagent generalized. So I'll say RMgX. It attacks the carbonyl, pushes it open, same way hydroxide would. End up with a similar-looking intermediate. We have R instead of hydroxide, of course, but we still have an alkoxide. But if we still argued that that alkoxide had a conjugate that maybe had a pKa of 17, the Grignard reagent, its conjugate, is an alkane, which means its pKa is somewhere around 60. 60. 60 means it's so much less acidic than an alcohol would be. 43 orders of magnitude lower, which even if we were to work some kind of ice problem with that and try to establish that some change in concentration might occur of 10 to the negative 21st. It means that even if one mole of the stuff reacted, that only a dozen or so molecules would even try to go in the reverse direction. So although on paper, whenever you say equilibrium, technically that means reversible, it's so imbalanced that this is really just not a reversible reaction. So this step is, for all purposes, not reversible since the reagents differ greatly in base strength. So when is it? I'm sorry, Carolyn. You're saying if we had something like, but what you're asking is what happens if we flip it? If like the product had the huge pKa and the reagent didn't?
Yeah, because that's just How about I show you one like that? Which you just have to anticipate that's exactly where we're going next. And the case I want to use is the personification of an amide, because that's exactly the situation you're describing. Anybody have a lecture text on them?
May I look at your inside front cover? It's on the back.
Oh, yes, it does have approximate pKa values. An amine, higher than I thought it was. It says up around 40. I thought it was in the low 30s. Just got some studying to do before I get to that part.
So we're still dealing with hydroxide and an alkoxide at first in this saponification. So the first part of this mechanism is reversible, again, because of the comparable base strengths. But now look, if we have this alkoxide, which let's again assume its conjugate is got a pKa roughly of 17. How's that going to compete when trying to kick out an amine? If it technically is true, that the conjugate of that amine has a pKa as high as 40, which your text seems to indicate. Is there any way this reaction is going to want to happen? Let me frame the question again. We have an acid with a conjugate pKa of 17. We have another product that gets made whose conjugate has a pKa of 40. That means the base that's expelled in this reaction is a heck of a lot more basic than what we start with in terms of either the hydroxide or the intermediate that we make. So if we were to write an arrow and we were being really technical about it, this is the type of arrow that we would use to show that this process is on paper reversible, but it doesn't really want to happen. But now we switch back into equilibrium mode and we say, okay, if equilibrium can happen, it will happen. And so even if it is only a few molecules that get generated any one time, if this thing happens, there's instantly a neutralization. Because we have an acid with a pKa of roughly 5 and a conjugate of an acid that's 40, instantaneous acid-base neutralization. If that neutralization happens, then there's no way the reaction can reverse from this point. So the reaction is not favorable to occur. It doesn't want to go forward. But if it goes forward, it's trapped. Gets caught up by that neutralization. And now doesn't reverse. So the overall mechanism in this case is irreversible, even though there's a portion of it that doesn't even want to happen. Because both an acid and a base are formed at the same time. before the reaction can reverse. And let me show you what I'm talking about. So, because both an acid and base are formed at the same time, then before the reaction step that formed them can reverse, they neutralize each other. Preventing that very reverse reaction. So, started off by reminding us that we have both cationic and anionic mechanisms. I've now addressed some or reviewed some questions of reversibility. Does this make the issue of reversibility a bit more clear for everyone? No? Or is it just because there's too much stuff and you need the time to study? Is that the better way to say it? That's the super simple reduction of it, but yes, that's it. If the PKs are similar, reversibility happens. If they're hugely different, it's not reversible. And it doesn't totally matter which way you go, yes. Well, but you get the general trend. So, there is one other issue, though, with reversibility that I wanted to re-examine. And that's the oxygen 18 question that came up in class. Because I asked you the other day, what would happen if you had a carboxylic acid and you exposed it to excess oxygen 18 water and acid? And I just sort of offhand said, oh, it's going to be just like esterification in terms of mechanism. But that's kind of a dangerous thing for me to say if you all are not comfortable with that mechanism, if you're not fluent in that mechanism. If your life depended on it right now, how many of you could jump up and write the mechanism for a Fischer esterification? Well, then that could explain why there's this confusion about the oxygen 18 mechanism. So I want to write that one out to highlight some issues with that. So remember that the question that came up that I asked you all was, what would happen if we had a carboxylic acid and we reacted it with H plus and excess oxygen 18? Well, the first step of that's reversible because it's going to be a round of protonate, open attack, deprotonate. Protonate the carbonyl. Carbonyl opens in resonance. The isotopically labeled water can attack. And because we had neutral water, even though it was an isotope, we're going to have a deprotonate step. Now, we have seen this kind of intermediate before that has three oxygens connected to it. Apparently, I didn't make enough of a big point about this before. But when you have three oxygens connected to the same carbon like this, it's not a thermodynamically favorable molecule. Think back last quarter when we saw hydrates. A hydrate is just a carbonyl that got turned into a double alcohol. Normally, that's not a favorable process. So if you end up with two alcohols on one carbon, then it's going to reform a carbonyl. We've got three alcohols on one carbon. This thing's really not that favorable, so it's going to form a carbonyl. But now, which one of the oxygens will get protonated to start that process? Well, any of them, really. Question did come up, though, in the other section about 018. Is there any difference, any, in the energy of protonation of a regular oxygen versus 018? Yeah, a small amount. Because 018 is a heavier atom, and so there's a slightly different bond strength between oxygen and hydrogen if you have 018. It shows up in what's referred to as the isotope effect, or sometimes what I'm about to describe is the kinetic isotope effect. Where if you wanted to try to figure out the mechanism of a reaction, you could start out with a compound with a regular hydrogen, start out with a compound that has a deuterium. If the two compounds have a different rate of reaction, it must be because you replaced that hydrogen with a deuterium, which tells you that it must have been involved in the rate-limiting step, because that's the only way there'd be a difference in the rate of reaction. And so it lets you figure out something about reaction mechanism. We'll come back to that idea about isotopes later. For right now, the main point is no, there's not a big difference in energy if any of these get protonated. And that's why this is reversible, and that's why an excess of that isotopic water was used to help push this reaction forward. Something productive, from our perspective, will happen if one of the regular oxygens gets protonated. Because that oxygen can then leave as water. Now, normally at this point, you would expect me to continue to make a carbonyl. One of the two oxygens would fall into the positive charge there, making the carbonyl, and then you'd have a subsequent deprotonation. But that thing that we form, if it continues to react, it's just going to get protonated and have its carbonyl open again. So in other words, why can't I just attack this right here at this point? Do I really need to show the formation of a carbonyl? No. Again, because making it's just going to be reversible. So you don't have to show it. Another molecule of isotopic water could attack at this point. It could come right back off again. Again, this is all just reversible. Once it does come on, we need, to deprotonate. And now to end up with what we really care about. The last regular oxygen gets protonated. Yes, one of the other oxygens could get protonated instead. That's the last time, the point of this all being reversible. But if the regular oxygen gets protonated, we move forward. That protonated oxygen leaves as water. one or the other of the remaining oxygens falls into the positive charge. We form a carbonyl that will get deprotonated. And we end up with our isotopically replaced acid. Questions about that mechanism? Yes?
Since there isn't much of a difference in the reactivity of the oxygens, then you technically get almost equal amounts of all the products.
No, because that's the point of the excess isotopic water. Because of its excess, if there's enough excess, you push it to completion. But if you didn't have that, then yes, you could end up with a mixture of products. Question?
I can't hear you.
Because we have enough oxygen 18 water is the only reason this reaction goes all the way to completion. As otherwise, regular water and oxygen 18 water could compete. So this is a Le Chatelier's principle driven reaction. Questions? Then what we really have left is a bit of chemistry of amides and a bit of chemistry of nitriles. Because we've already talked about acyl halides and esters. We've talked about their hydrolysis, aminolysis, solvolysis, reduction, and alkylation. We talked about carboxylic acids, and in this section, we saw what would happen in a Grignard reaction with a carboxylic acid, didn't we? The fact that you'll only form a ketone and not an aldehyde or something else. Okay, but we didn't finish talking about amides. More specifically, we didn't finish talking about the hydrolysis of amides. And we didn't talk almost at all about nitriles. So let's do that now. So, well, we did do some discussion of hydrolysis of amides today. You saw the saponification of an amide, the base hydrolysis. But let me go back now and fill in the acid hydrolysis of an amide. Oh, I don't know if the question came up here, but for the quiz, no nomenclature, because we haven't done the nomenclature of several of the carboxylic acid derivatives. So we'll tackle that after the quiz. So no nomenclature for the quiz. I'll get to that at the end. All right, so here's an amide. We're doing acid hydrolysis, which means the first step is going to be protonation of the carbonyl, followed by opening of that carbonyl. At that point, since it's hydrolysis, it'll be water that attacks. And then, of course, it deprotonates. At this point, we're kind of at the equivalent stage as we would be with a carbonylamine. Again, a functional group that doesn't want to be normally isolated. So we go through another round of protonate, open attack, deprotonate. Same issue of multiple side products, multiple reversible reactions being possible, in that if either one of the OH groups gets protonated at this point, we're going back to the beginning. But the nitrogen is actually more basic than the oxygen is. So at this point, it's more likely that the nitrogen gets protonated. Which, if it does, that makes an ammonium ion, which can leave. Once it leaves, we're in the same situation that we were in the reaction above, in that we have two OH groups and a positive charge, so one or the other donates a lone pair in to make a carbonyl, which then deprotonates to become neutral. Now, I did mention how in the base hydrolysis, the saponification, that part of that reaction is not favorable because you use hydroxide to kick off a stronger base. That's part of the reason why in real life you have to use harsh conditions to saponify an amide, even more harsh conditions than you would for an ester. That matches the trend that amides are less reactive than esters. Same type of thing here. Because the nitrogen lone pair is so heavily involved with delocalization with the carbonyl doesn't want as much to be protonated. It is more stabilized. The nitrogen here, nitrogen is normally basic, at least a weak base, but it's almost not at all basic here, again, because that same delocalization. So in other words, you need strong conditions here as well in order to get hydrolysis to work. I'm saying that because nitriles are less reactive than amides. So the same conditions that we are going to use, hydroxide and heat and water, or acid heat and water, they need to be just as severe, if not more severe, when we're trying to react a nitrile. We're going to see that nitriles form amides. So if those conditions can get a nitrile to make an amide, the same conditions are going to cause those amides that form to immediately react again. So nitriles, we're going to see, go directly to carboxylic acids. That's the last bit of chemistry we need to do now. A couple of asides real quick. There are two ways that we've learned to make nitriles. One is sneaky. It's an SN2 reaction involving what you might not otherwise think of as an organic molecule, sodium cyanide. It's got carbon in it, though. And when it does SN2, we do end up with a nitrile functional group. Another way we learned to do it, though, which I snuck in real quick at one point last quarter, was to use hydrogen cyanide on a ketone, which is going to make a functional group called a cyanohydrin. And I mention this because we're going to see this reaction again in just a few weeks when we do carbohydrates. Before I show you hydrolysis, let me quickly show you reduction, because it's easy in this case. If we write it synthetically, it is a 1-2 reaction. Reduction followed by acid workup. Mechanism-wise, because we don't have the complexation with the intermediates with aluminum like we do in the reactions we learned yesterday, I'm not going to write the aluminum hydride out like I did yesterday. I'll be lazy and space conservant and just show H minus attacking. Which, if you're using lithium aluminum hydride, you're not going to have a protic solvent, so there's really nothing to grab a proton from at this point. But it turns out that lithium aluminum hydride is reactive enough, it'll just react again. Of course, we make a dianion, which, as soon as we introduce acid, of course, we get a double protonation. And so the product of the reduction of a nitrile is an amine. Now, let's see those acid and base hydrolysis. Let's start with the base one first, because I think I tried to rush through that yesterday, didn't I? So, base hydrolysis starts out with hydroxide attacking the nitrile. We make a negatively charged nitrogen, which is really basic. And since we have hydroxide and since we're doing hydrolysis, we could also assume we've got some water around, which can provide the hydrogen for that negatively charged nitrogen to get reprotonated. There's going to be a big difference in pKa, so that much of it is pretty much irreversible. Now notice that we've just made the nitrogenous equivalent of an enol. So the next part of the mechanism is tautomerization. To write the mechanism in a slightly more condensed way, I'll show this being deprotonated, but remember that delocalization doesn't count as a reaction step. So I'm going to do some resonance at the same time, showing the bond that just got released collapsing back towards the carbon, kicking open the carbon-nitrogen double bond. When that happens, that means we now have a carbonyl. We again have a negatively charged nitrogen. So again, we could show water neutralizing that, which will get us an amide. But as I was commenting before I showed this mechanism, nitriles are less reactive than amides. So if we were successful in making a nitrile into an amide, those same reaction conditions would cause the amide to continue to react and make, in this case, a carboxylate salt. As a separate step, with acid workup, we could get to the carboxylic acid. That's acid hydrolysis. Let's do saponification. Oh, sorry. This is base hydrolysis. This is saponification. Now let's see the acid hydrolysis. So in acid hydrolysis, everything happens backwards from the base. The base version, the bond got attacked, and then protonation occurred. Here, protonation occurs, then the bond gets attacked. So protonation, since this is cationic, technically each step is reversible. So after protonating the nitrile, nitrile gets attacked by water, again pushing open that carbon-nitrogen triple bond. Gives us a carbon-nitrogen double bond, which means we've got an imine, but we also have the alcohol. Makes it unstable. Makes it like an enol. I guess technically it would be called an iminol. Since we're in acid conditions, we'll do acid tautomerization. So the nitrogen gets protonated. Separately, I'll show the delocalization. Which gives us a carbonyl again. Of course, it's a protonated carbonyl, so we lose a hydrogen, and we end up with an amide, which again, since they're more reactive than nitriles, they'll continue to react under the same conditions to make a carboxylic acid. Now we finished with all the material I wanted, but today was technically supposed to be a synthesis day. I'll tell you right now that multi-step synthesis is not one of the problems on the quiz. But the question came up earlier, what about fill-in-the-blank problems? Likely to have some fill-in-the-blank problems, because you do have all these different types of reactions you've seen. Hydrolysis, aminolysis, solvolysis, reduction, alkylation. Plus a whole slew of functional groups. Plus, for some of the reactions, we learned specialized reagents, like the dibal and the lithium tris, that big, long, nasty thing. The other reducing agent. So, seems to me that fill-in-the-blank problems are logical at this point. Why don't we do a couple of practice ones then, shall we? The yes of the hope that this will just show up on the quiz this way, right? So what if we have a carboxylic acid that we react with something to make an ester? If you look carefully at the wording of this tile of problem, when there's a blank where the reagents would go, there's no presumption about whether it's one or 1,2 or a mix of reagents. Of course, if your solution, you think you need to put 1,2,3,4,5,6,7,8, then maybe you're going the wrong track for your solution. But I say that because there is more than one answer here. Could someone give me a reasonable answer for this problem? H plus and ethanol, okay. That would work. That'd be Fischer esterification. But it would also work to first use thionyl chloride and then use an alcohol. Again, because the blank does not presume a certain number of reagents, this would be an acceptable answer. And I made the comment that I wouldn't want a multi-step synthesis. So if you had 8 steps, it would be a wrong answer. But 2, that's reasonable. Yes? Technically, yes. Let's do a couple other quick ones because we're almost out of time. Let's say we had something that reacted first with a Grignard reagent, 2 equivalents, and then work up with acid to make an alcohol. Now, what does the 2 equivalent part mean? That you used, they weren't just there, but you actually used 2 equivalents of the Grignard reagent. Well, what functional groups have we learned that use 2 of them? to make an alcohol. Ooh, that was just yesterday. That would be esters or acyl halides. Because remember, for both of them, after the addition of the first Grignard reagent, you make a ketone, which then reacts with another Grignard reagent to make an alcohol. But I think this is the section where we also saw that it would not work with a carboxylic acid. Because the first equivalent would just pull a hydrogen off. The second equivalent would attack, but then you'd end up with a double alkoxide, which can't react any further. So a carboxylic acid would be a wrong answer here. Done one with the reactants blank, the substrate blank, so let's do one with the product blank. This is almost too much of a hint, because you know I love these kinds of cyclic compounds. We actually did this one in class, so I'll just show you the answer. Questions? Then enjoy some of this wonderful weather. It looks like we're going to have this weekend.